Welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. Today with me, once again, is Professor Richard Sloan. Professor Sloan, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
It's great to be here. Well, let's talk about China.
Okay.
Okay. Ni chur fan le ma?
Wo chur fan le. That means I've had my meal for tonight.
I think that's right. We know a little bit of Chinese right there. So, China is in the news in all sorts of ways. Well, recently, Alex Jones revealed that his recent deplatforming from Facebook, run by Mark Zuckerberg, and YouTube, which is owned by Google, run by Sergey Brin and Larry Page, two Jews, and Spotify and some others, is because of the Chinese. Don't really have that figured out exactly why.
I hadn't heard that comment, but I can take a guess as to why, because I have heard Alex Jones accuse Google of you know, being a traitorous company because it wouldn't exist were it not for the United States. But it's basically moving into China, and in effect, it's conspiring with the Chinese. It's giving American information to China, and yet blocking things on the Chinese version of Google that the Chinese government doesn't want to be part of the Google database.
Is there a Chinese version of Google? Did Google just not do China?
I don't know.
Isn't there this company called Baidu? What is Baidu? Is that like Amazon?
I would have thought that Baidu was the Chinese Google, but I would have thought that Google also had some presence in China. I have both been to China. I recall doing searches on Google when I was in China, okay, and Chinese results would come up.
Okay. All right, but I think the rap against Google then, I know the rap against some of these companies is that they allow China to make demands on things to be censored. Of course, they're making demands on, I mean, they let the ADL or the Southern Poverty Law Center make demands and get, you know, people are getting kicked off YouTube right and left, and I believe doesn't YouTube have a partnership, or maybe it's one of the other companies, maybe it's Facebook, but they have a partnership with the ADL and SPLC in order to help them flag hate speech. But we're focusing on China right now.
We're going to focus on China in the course of this podcast. We started out talking about Alex Jones, right?
Yes.
It's been a few days since he's been deplatformed, and I haven't heard the comments that you had, but either the next day or the day after he was deplatformed, I made a point of downloading his app on my iPhone, and I listened to how he was spinning it, and he wasn't pointing the finger at China. Maybe he's changed his stance since, but he was pointing the finger at Mark Zuckerberg, and he was pointing the finger at the big tech companies, and the accusations that he was hurling at the tech companies was that they're in bed with the Chinese. Now maybe he's evolved from that stance since I listened to him.
I haven't listened to him at all. I've only like read third party stuff. Okay. So I don't 100% know. I know Andrew Anglin's spin on it, which can be, you know, very tongue in cheek and everything, is Alex Jones has gone full Nazi. He's calling out all the Jews except that he's calling them Chinese.
Okay.
So I'm not exactly sure what to think of that. But it's more than just Alex Jones. So you think of Tucker Carlson, for instance, and he wants to downplay the whole Russia hoax thing. And rather than rejecting it out of hand, saying, look, there's no evidence that they tried to meddle in our election, what does meddling even mean? Instead of saying that, he says, well, yeah, of course they're meddling in our elections, and I'm against that. But other countries meddle much more. What about the Chinese?
Right.
Or he'll say also, what about the Mexicans? He won't say, what about the Israelis? I think the whole time I've seen him, he's maybe mentioned Israel in that context once, and probably was warned never to do it again, because I haven't heard him do it again. But that's so that's another example
of the vilification of China.
Vilification of China. Now, and if you want to comment on that before I go to the next example.
Oh no, I've seen and heard Tucker make comments like that, and I think you're right.
Now you've got, and you raised this before the show, you've got Trump talks a lot about trade with China and a trade war with China. And, you know, Trump, I was talking to a foreign reporter not too long ago about this. And what I was trying to point out to the reporter is, well, he's very harsh on China regarding trade. He's not so harsh on China regarding military, right? Whereas a lot of people in the Obama administration, probably a lot of people in the Trump administration as well, but a big focus of the Obama administration, a big focus was on the South China Sea and on trying to contain China. They were making a big deal about the artificial islands China has been building, or the, if not artificial islands, the little uninhabitable rocklets that it's been using as a foundation to create islands, which it claims, and then from those little, tiny little islands, it gives them a large economic zone because of the law, the way the law of the Treaty of the Sea, the Law of the Sea Treaty was written. And so there's, in previous administrations, there's been a big focus on China as a military adversary. And Trump, at least in his own talking, maybe not his administration, but himself, is not belligerent militarily towards China. He talks very harshly in terms of trade with China. But then if you listen hard enough, at the end of the day, he'll say, or at the end of the speech, he'll say, well, but you can't blame them. I mean, they're just negotiating smartly. It's our fault because we've been negotiating stupidly. We've had the worst negotiators who are negotiating the worst deals. So you can't blame them.
Yep.
Yet, of course, he is embarking on a what he's called a trade war. Trade wars are good. You know, we can win trade wars.
Are you quoting Trump now, or do you think
he has? No, I'm quoting a tweet. He had tweeted once that trade wars are good.
Oh, okay.
But he's been slapping all sorts of tariffs on China, which maybe it's a good thing, maybe it's a bad thing, but it's not the same as threatening them militarily. But some people might think some people might take it more belligerently. How do you think about that with the Trump's talk about China being an unfair trader and whatnot?
Well, when he was first elected, he made a point sort of meeting Xi and making sure that, you know, the two heads of state sort of got to know each other and could agree on certain things. And I think they sort of worked together to force North Korea into a corner. And, you know, this is one of the things that he was elected to do is you know, change it up a little bit. You know, America has had a huge trade deficit with China for ages and ages and ages. China was, you know, had most famous nation status.
Most favored nation.
Most favored nation status way beyond the point that you would have thought that they needed it. China's now the second largest economy in the world, and we're still giving them all of these trade advantages, and the American economy, you know, was in sort of a pickle, which is why I think people elected Trump. And I think that if you have somebody who can and who is willing to renegotiate a lot of our trade deals with other countries, the, oh my gosh, how could he do this? You know, he's upsetting the apple cart. He says things that are so offensive to these world leaders, is sort of the last card that a lot of countries have left to play. You know, if Trump is creating a negotiating stance, you know, to play tough ball with Angela Merkel or Justin Trudeau or, you know, any other world leader, that's what you see right away on the mass media is, you know, oh, he's such a buffoon. He's so offensive. You know, we meaning, you know, the American elite worked so hard to create this delicate balance of world power, and Trump's just going to, you know, crash the whole world economy because he doesn't know what he's doing. Well, he's shaking things up in order to fix things. You have to sort of break things down. You have to sort of pull off the parts that you don't want in the machine in order to put new parts into the machine and retool it the way you want it.
Mm-hmm. So, over the past several years, in China, the Chinese stock market's been kind of a roller coaster. Their economic growth for the past 30, close to 40 years, has been pretty phenomenal. But for many, many years, for decades, they had double-digit growth, and then I guess it's been slowing down. I haven't checked it the past few years, but it's been slowing down to more like 7 or 8% growth per year, which is huge. I mean, you keep doing that. I mean, if you have 10% growth after 7 years, that's doubling the economy.
Yeah.
Right? And to have 10% growth, and you know, often they were more like 12 or 13, but to have 10% growth for 21 years is multiplying the economy. It's like doubling the economy, then doubling it, and then doubling it again. It's like 8 times, making it 8 times larger. And they've just, ever since Mao died and Deng Xiaoping took over and set it on this course where it's got a political system of a one-party communist, one-party communist state, but economic system where, well, the economic system is good, is white cat, black cat. If it kills mice, it's a good cat. I think that's really the official Chinese term for their economy. That was the official term by Deng Xiaoping for the economic direction, basically very pragmatic, and people will call it capitalist economy. Well, it's got aspects of that. It's got aspects of state guidance, but it's pragmatic and it's worked for them. But of course, it's also been export led.
Well, you made a good point a minute ago about GDP and growth, and reminding people what growth is. Growth is an economy becoming larger than it was before, year on year. That can only continue for so long. China had these phenomenal growth numbers because China was going from, you know, a dirt poor farming nation into an industrial nation. And China had all this super cheap labor, and as long as we weren't putting tariffs on the products that they were able to produce a lot cheaper than we could ever produce in the United States, because we had higher wages, because, you know, we had to give workers benefits and things, it was sort of destiny. China was preordained that the Chinese, that we were going to buy more Chinese products, that the industrialized world was going to buy a lot of Chinese products, and that their economy was going to grow because they were really good at making things. Mm-hmm. They were really good at copying manufacturing templates that had been designed in first world countries and making them with cheap third world labor and not having to worry about, you know, pollution containment laws and all sorts of other things that make it more expensive to produce in the developed world. But that begins to hit a ceiling when your populace begin to get a little bit of wealth, and when people's living standards start to rise, and eventually your cost of labor starts to come up along with it. So the Chinese economy could only have those phenomenal numbers for so long. It's not like anybody threw a wrench in the machine and killed what, you know, killed the natural way of growth for the Chinese economy.
Mm-hmm. It started in the 1980s. Of course, they had some internal reforms, but regarding international trade, they opened up certain areas, certain regions around coastal cities for foreign investment. And the first one was Shenzhen. I think I'm saying that right. It's just outside of Hong Kong. And of course, there was a huge number of wealthy Chinese in Hong Kong who spoke the same Cantonese language as the people in Shenzhen, just outside of Hong Kong. And they made it easy for these people with their Hong Kong dollars, which was a hard currency, to come in and build factories and exploit the cheap labor there. And Hong Kong is a giant port and was already exporting loads of stuff from its own factories. And that worked well. And then they opened up a few more port cities, some just on the other side of the Taiwan Straits. And even though Taiwan politically and even militarily was its big enemy, you were already getting Taiwanese business, Taiwanese investment, or at least interest in investment, going into Shenzhen. So they, certainly they opened up these port cities on the other side of the Taiwan Straits and let the Taiwanese come in. They opened up, I think it was what used to be called Port Arthur or Dairen, right at the southern tip of Manchuria, which is close to Korea. They just started opening up places, and you know, they were attracting a lot of overseas Chinese and Korean and Japanese investment, but also Western investment. And this continued, it accelerated into the 90s, and then eventually pretty much the entire country was open up for this type of thing. But the investment that they wanted, it was, I don't know about the Hong Kong people at the very beginning, but once it got to Japanese or Western companies, the idea was you'd start a joint venture. So you would start a new company, which could be no more than 49% owned by the foreigner. Foreign company, Hitachi or Apple or whatever, they would come in, build, create a joint venture company that would be where the Chinese side would always have the majority ownership, the majority stake. And there would be it would be conditioned on a lot of technology transfer. So local people would be learning all this technology. These Chinese partners, which would typically, at least in the early days, be state-owned entities. These state-owned entities would be getting a lot of technology, would be in control of the factories, but the Apple could make a lot of, or whomever, could make a lot of profit off of it. Now, I know that when I was studying China in the 1990s, a lot of things have changed since then, and so I don't know exactly how it is now, but you know, it's changed to an extent, but you still have this legacy. There's still a legacy of that continuing. And so the trade deals have always favored China in that, technology transfers are kind of a one-way street, and China's really, really benefited from it. And it certainly is time to change it. And your position was that Trump has to really shake things up, otherwise it's not likely to change.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to say about China. I was thinking of several things as you were reminding us of the history of China's developing economy and industrialization. But one thing that you threw into my mind that kind of relates back to Trump is the joint venture arrangement. It still exists today. There a lot of China's biggest companies are still joint ventures, and this is one thing that I want to tell people when they say, oh, you know, like if we put these tariffs on Chinese imports, then they're going to put these tariffs on American imports, and they're just going to crash the whole world economy, and we Americans are going to suffer. The Chinese have been very strategic in the threats that they've made and the tariffs their retaliation tariffs. You know, like they want to hurt whiskey businesses in the Midwest because they'll be in a lot of pain, and they'll appear on American TV, and it'll look like, you know, the poor American businessman can't sell his whiskey anymore. But in actuality, China's ability to retaliate is very limited because of these joint ventures. Because you can't just say no and shut out McDonald's, because McDonald's is, you know, I don't know what percentage, just like you don't know exactly, we're doing this without having all the facts in front of us, but let's say McDonald's is 53%, I'm just making up a number, 53% owned by
the
Chinese.
Well, we are up on our first break, so we will come back after the break, and we've got more exciting things to talk about. Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anybody who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Without having all the facts in front of us. But let's say McDonald's is 53%, I'm just making up a number, 53% owned by the Chinese. Mm-hmm. So if you shut down that business, if you say McDonald's, you can't sell hamburgers anymore in China, you're hurting Chinese businesses more than you're hurting American businesses. There's a lot of those cases. So it really is harder than the media would have you believe for China to retaliate. And she's on, you know, very delicate ground, and you know, the Chinese political system is a lot less stable than we've come to think. And there's a lot there. Well, we can get into later talking about how the greatness of the Chinese economy is in many ways a big illusion. But the point I wanted to make is that the media, because they hate Trump, will tell you that Trump's just, you know, Trump's about to awaken a sleeping giant, and we Americans are really going to regret it if we start playing hardball with the Chinese and start this trade war. I think America has very little to lose and everything to gain, and it's China that really doesn't have a hand to play. It's China that has a lot more to lose and doesn't really have many ways to retaliate.
So we've both been to China. I went there in the 1980s, and the place was just completely dirt poor. I mean, when I say dirt poor, I mean you go into people's houses and they had dirt floors. This is very common. And I even saw people literally living in caves in Chongqing, I guess. We used to call it Chongqing. It was famous as Chongqing during World War II. And the nationalist government actually had moved from Nanjing to Chongqing to get away from the Japanese, and also because Chongqing has a lot of nice caves, and the caves are natural bomb shelters. But when I went to Chongqing, there were people living in the cages, and you'd walk
caves,
caves, and you'd walk up the street, and I just remember like people coming out of these gates. The caves had gates, and some Chinese guy out there brushing his teeth on the sidewalk in front of his cave. It was very, very poor, and there was nothing there that seemed to have any value. And I'm talking about maybe a little more than 30 years ago, and it's just, it's amazing. But now you were there more recently than that.
Your story about the cave just reminded me of a counter story, an interesting story that kind of makes the same point, though it may not have much to do with politics or economics. But I remember being in Shanghai, all of these huge, beautiful, ornate buildings that date back to the concessions that the Chinese had to give, you know, the various European traders that wanted to come in and establish a base and do trade with the Chinese. All of these beautiful buildings with just basically like peasants running around them, and you know, like people carrying this is as recent as, you know, 2010, 2011, people carrying their soap and their towel and their bathing goods so that they could go to, like, a public bath, or, you know, people, like, sort of sleeping in the park outside of these. It just was such a you know, sort of strange contradiction, strange visual contradiction. These beautiful buildings and these peasants, you know, living in them or sharing them or using them as bathhouses and things.
Well, then the Chinese stock market, we were talking about the Chinese economy, the stock market's been on, over, if you look at the past 4 years or so, a roller coaster. In the summer of 2015, it was like, it just shot up and then crashed just over the summer. I mean, you know, it went up high and thinking, next thing you know, it was way down again. And since the beginning of this year, since the trade wars talk has started, there's been, it's declined, but it hasn't crashed. And our stock market's declined, it hasn't trashed. And when you crashed, well, ours had declined some, and it's recaptured, and it depends which index you're looking at. But when you listen to business news, you know, often they'll say, oh, today something happened due to the market's worries of a trade war with China. You know, maybe the worries are increasing, or maybe they're decreasing, and so the market went up. So there seems to be some sort of impact, but it's not massive. The other thing regarding China that I wanted to get into, and I kind of mentioned it already, was in the Obama administration, for sure, and to an extent before that, you had this push by a lot of Jewish intellectuals, but not just Jewish intellectuals, to turn it into the military adversary. And there are those who say that, you know, if America didn't have an enemy, it would invent one. And to the extent that's true, China's the one that's being invented, at least by some. I mean, lots are, you've been hearing all this stuff about Russia, 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 and a lot of it's made up, and a lot of the people, you know, like Tucker, who push back at it, will talk about China. But there had been, I remember, how many years ago would it have been? Maybe 6 years ago or so. Noah Feldman. He was a Harvard University law professor. One of these people that Elena Kagan had hired, and he wrote a book called The Cool War, as opposed to the Cold War, but it was basically, I mean, the way I looked at it is like, oh, okay, you got Jews, this must have been before the Ukraine stuff happened, but okay, Jews trying to turn China into the enemy now. And of course, the way I see it, I mean, it's just as it's not Russia that's...
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anybody who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the CoSertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
The way I looked at it is like, oh, okay, you got Jews. This must have been before the Ukraine stuff happened. But okay, Jews trying to turn China into the enemy now. And of course, the way I see it, I mean, it's just as it's not Russia that's forcing us to accept unlimited numbers of Honduran and Somali immigrants. It's not China either. Now, China is sending over a lot of Chinese are coming to America. They're not causing as much trouble as a lot of other immigrant groups, but our problems are so much not due to foreign enemies, but due to an elite that has been under control of Jews largely, and has been causing us to have basically suicidal policies. And so I'm always somewhat alarmed to hear hostile talk about China, because I don't mind Trump doing his trade war thing. That's he was elected for, you know, immigration first and foremost, but maybe his second biggest issue was trade. I mean, I'd like to think his second biggest issue was America first foreign policy, or isolationism, but really he probably talks more about trade than that.
Well, you remind me that when there was this vilification of China, I wouldn't, you know, if somebody brought it up, I wouldn't push back against them the same way that you might have. I wouldn't have said, no, China's not the bad guy. But if somebody griped about, you know, China's insistence that they have a right to some island, you know, that the Philippines says is theirs, or that Japan says is theirs, the remark I would have made is, well, what we have to worry about with China is, you know, they've taken over our industry. They, you know, all of these American production plants have moved to China. We have to start taxing their imports. We have to start putting tariffs on their imports. I might not necessarily have disagreed with the points that they were making about these little territorial disputes, but I was a lot more concerned about the impact it was having on trade. And so personally, since the election, I like everything that Trump has done vis-a-vis China. Is, as you said earlier in the hour, Trump hasn't made any noise about, you know, little military disputes here and there, and he's pushing back against... he's pushing back in the area where China is the biggest threat to American security, and that's in terms of trade. He also makes statements about backdoors and hacking and the danger of, you know, like American computer companies buying Chinese parts that have, you know, built-in what do they call them? Not viruses, not
backdoors,
not back. Well, backdoors as well. But what's it called when I can't think of it right now. When a Trojan horses is the word I'm looking for. But semiconductors made in China with Trojan horses built into them. Anyway, so Trump's mentioned those a little bit, but what Trump has pushed back mostly on is trade, and I think, you know, that's... If you'd have asked me before the election why did I support Trump, I would have given three reasons, and one of them would have been a lot of these, a lot of our trade policies and a lot of our trade agreements need to be renegotiated, and I haven't seen anybody step up to the plate and actually say that they wanted to do this, and who sounded like they understood what the problem really was prior to Trump. Mm-hmm. Now, I'll throw this out as a question and give you a chance to talk because it's your show. Marco Rubio.
Marco.
Has been one
Rubio.
Of the anti...
Let's do that, okay? Marco.
Rubio.
Okay. Next time we're in the pool, you should do that.
Okay. He's been one of the anti-China voices that you've been hearing on the media a lot. What's your take on him?
Yes, he has been. And I'm glad you mentioned him because that's kind of the perfect example. He's a big neocon. Now he's made all sorts of noise about Vladimir Putin. Maybe this is his way of talking less about Vladimir Putin, and you know maybe he sees the writing on the wall that President Trump is determined to improve relations with Russia. He's been on Tucker's show a few times. Sometimes when Tucker's not on the show, because you know Tucker takes a week off here and there. Marco Rubio comes on, and you know Tucker is anti-China and talks about China as an enemy, and Marco Rubio is willing to jump on that. And I mean, Marco Rubio isn't pro-Russian the way Tucker really. Tucker does seem to be pro-Russian, and he's had on Professor Cohen on a couple of times. So, yeah, Marco Rubio, the thing about Marco Rubio is he's a big neocon, and, you know, he's really super pro-Israel. I think a lot of these people, if there has to be an enemy to distract, who's the real enemy? I mean, the real enemy is Jewish power, and Israel's a big hunk of that Jewish power. And so I think you're going to find people in Congress who are, you know, maybe they don't want to talk... I mean, you got people like Lindsey Graham and, you know, McCain who are more than happy to go along with the whole Russia hacking Democratic Russia hoax myth. And you got people in Trump's own administration like Kirstjen Nielsen, who's the Homeland Security Director, who jumped down that path. And I guess being hostile towards China is kind of a way of not going along with the Democrats on Russia, but still deflecting attention away from Israel. So that's my take on Marco Rubio.
Yes, I do see your point. Is there's no reason to vilify China in every way. These renegotiations of trade agreements, these trade wars, are only going to be effective if they are done peacefully. If China becomes the enemy in all ways, you know, they could snowball into something else. And as I say, I was impressed with Trump in the beginning, you know, before he started really talking about trade to China. He sort of, you know, met with the Chinese and made sure that, you know, he was on the same, you know, he was on the same page with their leaders and that you know, like adults, there would be room for renegotiation. Now, the Chinese aren't going to willfully, you know, Xi is on delicate ground, as I said, because he cannot be perceived as playing into the American hand, or it will have negative effects on him politically. But, you know, I think that the game Trump is trying to play is only going to help America, and I agree with you, I suppose, that one thing that could sort of hurt his efforts is if Americans en masse start to see China as the enemy in every way, and there becomes too much anti-Chinese sentiment. But I don't think that's really in danger of happening from what I'm seeing on the mass media. Mm-hmm.
Here's something I'm going to throw out, and I think this is interesting. I think the viewers, the listeners will find it interesting. Is Korea, the way Trump's blossoming best friends forever bromance with Supreme Commander, the revered Supreme Commander Kim Jong-un.
Yep.
I think this is actually very, very significant, potentially, because if you have a reduction in tensions between North and South Korea, and you remember after that that press conference after the Kim-Trump summit, Trump was saying, hey, we've had these bases in South Korea for decades, and our boys want to come home. We got to, you know, our troops want to come home. We got to bring them home, and it costs a lot of money, and raising the prospect of withdrawing from South Korea, where we've had anywhere between, like, you know, 25 and 50,000 troops stationed there for the past several decades. And of course, there, you know, these massive bases. Here's what happens if, you know, right now it seems like a unification between North and South Korea is so difficult because they have very, very different systems. You've got basically a dynastic kind of, you know, central command monarchy, nominally communist monarchy, with massive state ownership in the north, and then you've got this, you know, electoral democracy with certain restrictions, but electoral democracy and these massive private conglomerates with so much economic power in the south, you know, conglomerates like Hyundai and Samsung. And how could they possibly merge? And maybe they can't merge. Maybe they don't have to merge. Maybe they just have a confederacy where they're going to have two separate systems, but, you know, in such a way that southern investment can take care of, can take advantage of the northern educated labor force. Well, what does that do if you have this rapprochement, and both North and South Korea have massive, massive militaries? The societies, North Korea in particular, but South Korea too, has been very, very militarized. And so it's like with Japan, you've got massive military potential, but Japan has a very small military. It's got basically an officer corps, and then it's got all the makings of nuclear weapons, but they you know, they could slap them together, but they don't. With South Korea, you've got, you know, it also has a nuclear power industry, a very big nuclear power industry. They get a lot of their electricity from nuclear power. They've got a rocket program. They've got a on Jeju Island, they can launch satellites, and of course North Korea can launch satellites, and they can they've exploded nuclear weapons. And they have, you know, tanks and airplanes and all of this stuff. What happens if those military assets aren't aimed at each other anymore? They're friends. They don't have to aim them at each other. All of a sudden, they become the third major power, the third native major power in East Asia. And if the United States were really to withdraw from South Korea, and Trump, at least in the election campaign, had hinted, why not just retreat from Japan? Or, you know, withdraw from Japan also. You don't have an American military over here, but you've got, instead of a North and South Korean military aimed at each other, you've got a, if not unified, at least allied to each other, Korean. You've got this Korean alliance, which could be the balancer. So
between China and Japan?
Between China and Japan, or between China and, you know, the West, you know. And to have, I mean, Japan by itself, in its present form, relatively unmilitarized, it can't balance all the way against China. But Japan and Korea together could. Of course, Korea and China could overwhelm Japan, but there's no reason for that. So I think that this rapprochement that has been going on between Trump and Kim and between the South Koreans and the North Koreans could lead to a very different dynamic in East Asia, and one where the United States could withdraw and it wouldn't be leaving the whole region to Chinese hegemony. It would just leave it to a an Asian balance of power, and the Asians would probably work out something on their own. You know, what business is it of ours on the one hand, but on the other hand, I think it would probably work out just fine. The Koreans and the Japanese have their own issues against each other, but I think they would you could have a very reasonable a trilateral balance of power between the three. How does that sound?
Sounds, I mean, it's another example of a logical thinking person being able to imagine something that the mass media today can't imagine.
The mass media can't imagine. It's an example of the type of new things that are possible when you've got somebody like Trump who is willing to shake things up. You were talking at the beginning of the show about him shaking up things trade-wise and economic-wise. And, you know, he has talked about withdrawing troops from Korea, talked about, you know, well, not necessarily even caring if if Japan and South Korea develop nuclear weapons. And, you know, I'm against nuclear proliferation, but honestly, both Japan and South Korea have all the makings and could slap something together very quickly. And of course, North Korea's shown it can do that. And, you know, even if it dismantles its nuclear program as promised, you can never put the genie back in the bottle. You can't make North Koreans stop being good at science and engineering, right? Unless you go in and they're lobotomize them all.
Okay.
So what else do we need to touch on?
Well, China has this really grand reputation throughout the world as, you know, being the second largest economy and, you know, being so developed and technologically advanced, and they've got this new clean subway system. And, you know, if you've ever visited China for just a few days, and you've only been to the big cities, you've only been to Beijing or Shanghai, you see a lot of rich people, and you see a lot of, you know, shopping centers that are newly constructed, and it looks like a lot of money have gone into them, and they don't even have customers yet. They've thrown it up so quickly that the customers haven't even caught up and gotten into the shopping center yet. But if you scratch just a little bit below the surface, you see that there's a lot of things in China that make this big economy look like a facade. For one thing, the markets are not reliable investments. It's not a high trust system. If you're an investor and you're thinking of putting money into Chinese assets, you're a very risk tolerant investor, mm-hmm. because you don't really know where, you know, you don't really know if the reports that you're getting are accurate or just made up. I mean, you know, every country has a little bit of that, but China has a lot of that. And there's a lot of government subsidies. I was there just a few years ago, and for a couple of bucks, you could get on a taxi and you could go across town because gasoline is so heavily subsidized by the government. So that sort of warps the reality of the economy. These huge real estate bubbles in the big cities also sort of warp the reality. There's, you know, trillions of U.S. dollars worth of just, you know, fake assets that will all disappear when those bubbles pop. So there's a lot going on in China that's sort of smoke and mirrors, and we have to remember that, I think.
Okay. Well, we're just going to wrap up in a minute or so. I want to thank you for having come on short notice. You know, it's not the first time either. Is there something we forgot?
Well, there's one other thing we can mention is that the changes, the growing pains that China has been going through for like the last 10 years now, and it's sort of, you know, been resisting, is it's time really for the Chinese economy, if it is capable of making this evolution. China has to go from being a producer of the world's junk.
Oh, we're going into the next break, so we'll get with the thing after the next break. Thank you.
if it is capable of making this evolution. Chinese production, China has to go from being a producer of the world's junk on the cheap to high-end products. Let's not forget that this happened with Japan. Mm-hmm. Once upon a time, made in Japan was a joke.
That's right.
Once upon a time, Japan was a producer of the world's junk. And sometime around the 1980s, it began to dawn on the Japanese that they can't continue this. You know, the yen that they had suppressed as long as they could was going to explode. Mm-hmm. And at some point, the only way that their economy and their industry was going to continue is if they made high-quality goods. Mm-hmm. Japan made that transition. China has just been kind of stuck in the middle, half trying to make that transition, but not really proving capable because everything's come kind of too quickly. Mm-hmm. It's gone from dirt poor farming country to this alleged cutting edge high tech world.
Which still has lots of poor farmers.
Which, yeah, you get outside the cities and there are probably still people living in caves, as you mentioned at the beginning of the hour. So it's been too quick. China's not really there. China's not in the place that Japan was in the mid-80s where it could see its yen inflate, you know, close to 100% mm-hmm. within a year mm-hmm. and still be a viable economy because Sony, you know, had a reputation in the early 80s of making these cheap products. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it invented the Walkman. It invented the Betamax. It actually was cutting edge. And it was in a place where it could go to be a high-end company. Mm-hmm. How many Chinese companies are there?
Yeah, yeah. When I watched Jim Cramer on, he has a show called Mad Money. And people will always call up and they're asking about these Chinese stocks. And he says, there's only three Chinese stocks I recommend. I guess it's Baidu and Alibaba and one other guy slips my mind. Otherwise, neither
of those two are manufacturing.
They're not manufacturing either. You know, one of the things that happened to Japan was in the 1980s when there was Dick Gephardt, who was a House Majority Leader, a Democrat, and he was really ran for president in '88, I think. But he had been really, really, kind of the face of let's be protectionist against Japan. And there were a lot of these trade agreements, voluntary restraint. I guess it was Japan agreed to a lot of voluntary restraints. And the way the restraints would work is, okay, we're only going to export so many units of automobiles. We're going to only export so many units of this or that. Well, what they did is, instead of a Honda Civic, a Honda Civic's a very nice car now. It's kind of a high-end car. A Honda Civic in the 1970s was tiny. It had, you could practically pick it up and put it in your pocket. The tires and the wheels were just tiny. They looked like go-karts. And so they just transformed, okay, well, if we can only sell 100,000 cars this month, we're going to sell high-end luxury cars. And it was transformative. And this type of thing can be an opportunity. Russia's used its the sanctions against it in order to move to an import substitution economy.
I remember sitting down with somebody who knew a lot about manufacturing and producing products in Japan, and he counted on his finger. There were five things, and I'm sorry, I can't remember on the spur of the moment for your show what the five things were, but it was like, you know, you have to have innovation, you have to have adaptability, you have to have, and he counted out these five things, and he said, of those, China only has two. And I can't remember, I'm sorry, I can't remember what they were, but it was basically what he was saying is like, China's very good at copying. China's very good at cheaply mass producing something, but they're not good. They can't go to the next level the way that Honda was able to. You know, Honda was able to shift from a maker of goods that sold because they were cheap to goods that sell because they're high end in quality. And China's not there.
Okay, well, thank you so much for coming on the show. I look forward to having you again sometime soon.
Okay, thanks very much.
And I'll be back again soon with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.